Welcome to Children's Home and AIDS Ahlquist Center for Policy, Practice, and Innovations podcast, The Ahlquist Agenda. I'm Eric Mayo, Public Policy Manager at the Ahlquist Center. In this series, we invite you to take an inside look at how we think about policy, why it matters, how it impacts youth, families, and communities, and what you can do to help. In today's episode, we talk about the child welfare system and how to best support families before they become entangled within the system. We recognize that we have been a part of the establishment of the modern public child welfare system. This system was built to protect children, but in many ways became an avenue for the majority culture, usually white Europeans, in positions of power to determine who or what children should be protected from. That resulted in the removal of children from families living in poverty, immigrant families, indigenous families, and black or brown families. These children were removed from their families and their communities and then placed with families who were deemed appropriate by those in power to protect and care for those children. We have seen firsthand how this child welfare system has not stabilized families and, in many cases, caused irreparable harm to the very children it was trying to help. We also realize that this isn't a new issue. We'll link to some of the thought leaders in this space in the episode notes. The racist roots of this system continue to be seen today. According to a 2017 study in the American Journal of Public Health, 53% of black children nationwide experience a child protection investigation before they turn 18. In Illinois, according to a brief from the Child and Family Research Center at the University of Illinois School of Social Work, black families are twice as likely to be investigated for child abuse or neglect than their counterparts. And according to the latest child trends data, 89% of entries to foster care are for neglect in Illinois, 25 percentage points higher than the national average. We know that many of these neglect cases are really poverty-related. We believe we have a role to play in transforming the system to truly serve children and their families, to begin to confront our own shortcomings and to explore new, innovative ways to solve complex social problems. We held an event, Breaking Barriers, Centering Families, Transforming Systems, to begin the conversation about what it will take to create a more equitable and just future for all children, families, and communities. As part of this event, the Ahlquist Center convened a panel of policy leaders to discuss how to replace systems that harm families with those that promote true well-being. A link to the full panel discussion can be viewed in the episode description. To continue the rich discussion that was started at Breaking Barriers, we're joined by Jen Auguste and Amanda Whitlock. Jen is the founder and president of JRA Consulting and has a long history in working to transform the culture of child welfare organizations. She serves as a project director at Casey Family Programs for the first two Breakthrough Series collaboratives conducted in child welfare and continues to serve as the lead consultant on BSCs across the country. Jen has focused specifically on how organizational changes are tested, implemented, and ultimately sustained in child welfare systems. Amanda is Children's Home and AIDS Senior Vice President of Child Welfare and Behavioral Health. Amanda is a licensed clinical social worker and oversees all our child welfare services statewide that reach close to 5,000 children and families, including over 1,200 children who are in foster care. Jen and Amanda, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So before we begin, I wanted to say, you know, we know listeners can't see us, but we did want to recognize that while families of color are overrepresented in the child welfare system, everyone currently participating in this podcast happens to be white. We have value in the space, but it is important to recognize that the goal is to meaningfully partner with families of color and families with lived experiences in the system when talking about transforming oppressive systems. So, Jen, I'm going to start with you. When people say reform the child welfare system, what does this mean? And what do you believe we really should be talking about?
I always think that's a great way to start a conversation around this issue, Eric. And for me, reform just isn't enough. When I think about reform, I think about, you know, moving pieces around that already exist, right? We're literally reforming something, which implies that what we've got is pretty solid. And I would suggest that what we have is not solid. I prefer language of either transform or abolish. And abolish doesn't mean we don't need something to keep children safe. But what we have is clearly a racist system that isn't helping families or children stay safe or stay well. And I think sometimes we need to actually push past the safety conversation to the wellness and health conversation. You know, the metaphor I really like is the one of thinking about when I hear people say we need to, you know, rip the plant up by the roots. The way I think about that continuum with that metaphor is if we're reforming, all we're doing is we're pruning a plant. If we're transforming, we're pulling it up by the roots. But when we start to talk about abolishing and rebuilding, to me, that's when we're digging up the soil that has let this racist system become what it is, and has let what's happened to children and family, particularly children and families of color in this country, what's happened to them. And that's what we see now. Amanda, anything you would want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, this is a racist system, and we know that the majority of families are separated for racialized poverty. So child welfare is not going to address and solve racialized poverty. We have to move farther upstream. The garden, from your analogy, has to get bigger, right? We can't just look at the child welfare garden. We have to look at the institutional societal system of racism and power and really shift those dynamics. We know that that's going to take a long time to do, unfortunately. So there are things we can do within the child welfare system. We have to be able to identify and confront and act on the harm we know that the child welfare system is doing. We have to really look at how do we empower families in the system? How do we narrow the front door? How do we widen the back door so that families that are in the system aren't continually harmed while we wait to fix society's bigger racial issues? And I think, you know, what's going to be really important when we yank up this plant and replant a system that really helps is how do we center families at that solution and planning stage.
You know, what you said, Amanda, makes me think a lot about some language that we use, that very often we talk about child welfare as if it's a single agency. And I think that's part of why I am so opposed to the notion of just the language of reform, because reform, once again, implies that it's just this one single agency that somehow is expected to solve all of these issues that are so much broader than what a child welfare agency is designed to do in the first place. I often use the language in my work that every system is perfectly designed to achieve exactly the results that it gets. And to that end, if we look at child welfare agencies across the country, they're doing a fantastic job for what they were designed to do, which is to separate families, right? To feed this sort of foster care industrial complex, which was designed again and incentivized to separate children and families, not to support them. And what you pointed out, Amanda, in your comments just now, was the real need to get to a child welfare system approach and recognize that if we're really talking about child welfare in the way that I think the language is meant to be, as opposed to the way that we've interpreted the language over the years, the true wellness and welfare, well-being of children, it's a system. And it's a system that includes housing and education and employment and small businesses and large businesses and healthcare and mental health and all sorts of supports and family systems. It is not about a single agency that investigates and does punitive action, right? It's not a carceral system. But yet when most people in this country hear child welfare, they immediately go to the foster care industrial complex, as opposed to this broad system of all of these multiple organizations and individuals and communities that really should be supporting families. And that's where I think, honestly, the switch, that's the transformation, and why if we abolish the agency and really focus on the broad system instead, that's where our opportunity lies. And that's where, to me, the strategies of hope and actually success lie.
So as I was doing the research when we're producing this episode, you know, one of the facts that stood out to me the most was, according to the latest Child Trends data, 89% of entries to foster care are for neglect in Illinois.
Right.
That's 25 points higher than the national average. And we know that many of those are poverty related in some form. So Amanda, what is the child welfare system ill-equipped to address? And what other systems are needed to help families succeed on their own?
So to help families succeed on their own, we really need a system, as Jen referenced. It can't be a agency. It can't be a department. We need a system in which there is childcare available for families. There is employment opportunities. There's housing. There's universal income. There's community resources. There's accessible healthcare. A lot of the things that families end up being deemed as neglectful for aren't as simple as they chose not to get healthcare. They chose to not utilize childcare. There weren't resources available in their community, or they did not have the flexibility that I have with my employer to take some time off to go to the doctor. And again, when I take time off to take a loved one to a doctor, I have a set appointment time. I know how long I'm going to be there. Unfortunately, our families in brown and black communities, they can't necessarily make an appointment. It could be a 6-8 hour wait to go to a doctor's appointment for a follow-up. So the reality of the system is we don't have the basic supports in place for everyone in our society to access healthcare, education, childcare, employment, transportation. So the child welfare system has families that need those things, and the child welfare system is not set up to actually help create those services for families. If the families had access to those services, they wouldn't need our assistance, and they don't exist because there are service deserts for many of the basic needs families have in our society.
Well, and if it's okay, I would even roll that back further, Amanda, because I can't help, Eric, as you shared those statistics, and we know nationally what that looks like. And we know that if you start looking not even just as, you know, neglect going into foster care, but neglect coming into child welfare, you know, the call from the mandated reporters, the numbers of neglect that are coming in are astronomical. And then we have to ask ourselves the combination, how is neglect related to poverty? Right? That we have to do. And when we ask that question, that's where I go rolling back to how no one can argue that the child welfare system is a racist system, right? Because what drives poverty in our country, right? The drivers of poverty, all those things that Amanda just listed, we know the historical underpinnings of things like housing, employment, education, right? The core three things that end up relating to accumulations of wealth and the converse, which is poverty in this country, right? All racist constructs. And so when we start talking about the influx of brown and black families for reasons of neglect, which is a way to say poverty by another language, right? We're talking about a system that is punishing poverty the same way that it did when it was founded in the 1900s, right? We're punishing people for being poor, yet we're in a system that is causing people and maintaining people in poverty. So when we start thinking about it in those terms, it makes us ask the question, to Amanda's point, why does an agency then trying to solve or address this issue that it didn't create? And how would it possibly do that? Further, why are we surveilling people, right? Why are we watching people and not trusting people because they're poor? What is it that we fundamentally don't trust in brown and black families who are poor that somehow says that they should be involved with a governmental system? The one example I want to give from a very pure child welfare perspective is this whole notion of kinship care. Now, I am the first to say I think kinship care is exactly where kids belong if they can't live with their families. But do I think it has to be involved with a child welfare agency? And so I always ask the question when I'm working with any child welfare agency of why do we have kinship care requirements for child welfare agencies? What is it that we don't trust in brown and black families predominantly that we say, yes, we want you to care for your own children, but we want to watch you do it because we don't know that you can do it well. We don't believe or we don't trust that you can keep your child safe. And we're not going to give you necessarily the resources and say, go take care of your own. Instead, we're going to say, no, you have to play by our rules. And we're going to keep raising the bar. We're going to keep changing the rules of the game. We're going to keep adding things to your service plan. It's like a lobster trap, right? That we're going to let you in, and then we're never going to let you out. And so to me, kinship care, while good, is one of the most racist policies we might have in our system right now.
It's interesting you say that, because I think one of the things I noticed from a policy perspective is this idea, there's a lot of programs or systems where if you are in foster care, you get a benefit. So the one that comes to mind right away, Head Start, right? You are automatically eligible for Head Start if you are in foster care. If we said, if a family is potentially going down that path, and we said, let us give you childcare, right? The family might not go down that path. Jen, as you said, it traps them in for a while.
Yep.
And the interesting thing about foster care is when a child comes into foster care, the non-relative or the substitute caregiver relative is given financial resources, is given assistance with transportation, is given access to a healthcare system, is given a caseworker who will advocate for your educational needs. But you have to be removed from your parents to access all of those supportive services. And again, we pay non-parents to raise children, but will not provide parents any type of cash assistance for just being a parent.
Yeah. And I can't help but say, as you say that, Amanda, I can't help but use the words chattel slavery, right? So we saw children, it's times of slavery, right? Black children were commodities, right? To be bought and sold, traded, right? It was for profit. And yet now we have this foster care system where we're now only providing money, right? We're only providing financial resources to families if we're allowed to take their children. And if you think about it in the grossest terms, that's what we're doing. We're saying we will take your children into our system and then we will give you money, but we will not give you any money or any support unless you let us take your children. And there's something that just, you know, makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up when I say that out loud, because that's just the grossest term to explain the way our system is designed. Every system is perfectly designed to achieve exactly the results that it gets. This is not about reform, right? We need something so much bigger because our system has been designed, even at the federal level, to really incentivize and encourage the removal of children rather than incentivizing and promoting systems where we believe that families can actually take care of their own. The one last bit of language I want to introduce in this section before I know we're moving on is that of white supremacy culture. And so we've also got this system and we think about, you know, an individual system where we're focused on a child. And rather than thinking on the health and the wellness of a family, we're always focused singularly on the protection and safety of a child. And not that I think that children shouldn't be safe, but I think from most cultures, children are safest in the context of their families, in the context of healthy communities. And yet our system is designed to singularly focus on an individual, which is a very white dominant culture, white supremacist frame for looking at humans, right? That again, if we start to shift it away from a Eurocentric frame to a multicultural frame, what we start to think about is where are families and communities and our vision in the child welfare vision? Why is it that the family and community aren't central to what we're looking at for wellness and for healing, and particularly for the healing of a child who needs healing?
Well, I think it goes back, Jen, to, again, why the system was created. And if it was created for a workforce and it was created for the greater good of white supremacist culture, because the reality you mentioned, parents, if you choose to give us your kids, parents don't choose to give the child welfare system their kids. And they have almost no power, authority, language, path to challenge the system when a white person calls on them and says, I'm concerned about how they're parenting. Their kids can be removed with zero adjudicatory process to actually defend themselves in this process. So from a policy perspective, we know that we have families that have their kids removed from their home, placed in a child welfare system for up to, in Illinois, it can be 2 years before they are even determined guilty, adjudicated of the allegation that was brought against them.
Wow.
So as we talk about this, I think our listeners, this is a big subjects with a lot of moving pieces and a lot of different directions one can go, a lot of different systems that need some reform. So I want to end on this point. What can we do as policymakers, as advocates, as folks who are in the day-to-day of the system, then sort of the general public, to continue or in some cases even start the work of transforming this system?
That's a really big question. I'm going to start with the word that Amanda used, which is power. When I think about racism and I think about white supremacy culture, you can't talk about either of those things without talking about power. One of the most important things we can do, or one of the many important things to do, is really to talk about and note where power is, who has power to do what. So the questions I like to ask always are, where and how are racism showing up here? Whether it's at our system level, at our decision-making level with children and families, at our partnership level, when we're procuring services, when we're contracting, where and how are racism showing up? I also like to ask separately and singularly, where and how are white supremacy showing up here? And those are two very different things. And I think that's important to note that racism is different than white supremacy, and really understanding where are our white dominant frames, our Eurocentric beliefs, our judgments and our power affecting and impacting the decisions that we're making, again, at all levels, at the system level, at the team level, at the family level. The last thing that I think we have to do is better understand how we share power with families and communities who actually need and should be rightly holding the power over their families' lives. And this isn't about giving up power or empowering people. And it's not about inviting people to the table. It's actually sharing power so that families and communities are deciding what the table looks like, are coming to the table, are creating the menus, are getting to eat, are sharing the meal, and that we're not giving them one seat among 40 and thinking that somehow we should pat ourselves on the back because we set a chair at the table, even though they never got a plate of food. So I think there's all of these things that we really can and should be doing. But in the center, to me, is this notion of power that we have to understand as a system, as a governmental agency, as people with this unbelievable ability to dismantle families, that we need humility and we need to understand the seriousness of the power that we have and use it wisely and use it fairly and use it justly. We have to get better at understanding the need for hope. And that's one thing that our agency does not give people and does not give communities and is not equipped to give people. Bryan Stevenson has this great line in one of his many brilliant talks where he says that hopelessness is the opposite of justice. That if what we're really doing is striving for justice, we need to actually be in the business of creating hope for people and families. And what we've become is a system that actually dismantles hope, that takes it away. So I think that building hope, rebuilding hope is a really, really important role that we need to find ways to do in working with communities and with sharing power in these real, authentic, meaningful ways.
Yeah, I know, Jen, I definitely agree with our need to really identify the racist policies that are punitive and oppressive. Being trained as a clinician, I often say that with insight comes responsibility. We have the insight that what we're doing is causing harm. Now we have the responsibility to really confront and act differently. Unfortunately, social services are set up in silos in which we compete against each other. And we often ourselves do not feel that we have the power to push back on our funder, the power to push back on the court system. So part of what really needs to change is some collective action that speaks out. We, as a social service agency, know the work we're doing. We know the policies that are harmful. How do we start speaking up for ourselves and for our families to really change the system? Because we are part of the problem when we accept contract after contract and continue to do business, because that's what we're doing is business, and really center ourselves on if we are going to make some systemic changes in our society, there are only so many resources. So we are going to have to very likely give up resources at the back end of this problem so that those resources can be moved forward to really help children and families never fail up into child welfare.
You know, there's one thing I also can't resist. I feel a real need to just note the shoulders of the giants that we're standing on with this. So here we are, as you mentioned at the very beginning, Eric, three white folks having this conversation. And I feel like it's completely disingenuous not to talk about the people who for decades, literally decades, have been talking about this. And their voices have actually gone heard by some and ignored by others and maligned by others. But, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, Dr. Bob Hill and Dr. Dorothy Roberts and Rhonda Miller and Leonard Burton and many of these giants in child welfare who have been talking about these issues for decades. And so I'm excited that this is a podcast. I'm excited that listeners are listening and hopefully taking note. And I also want to invite listeners to think about, you know, the words that Dr. Carol Spigner gave probably back in 2005 about these same issues and to ask themselves, why didn't we do anything then, right? Why are we still having these conversations when we've known about this for a really long time? So I also just invite people to think about the urgency that for decades we've known about this, for decades we've turned a blind eye. And so the urgency with which we must think about transformation, abolition, rebuilding is now more than ever because it's already gone on for far too long.
And I think for people to just really educate themselves, if you weren't aware of the problem, if you're listening to this podcast, you're now aware of the problem. And how do you challenge your own bias of a perfect perfect parent? How do you challenge your own bias of seeing a Black parent yell at a kid, redirect a kid physically in a store? You know, again, would you call the hotline on a white parent? What is factoring into your bias that the hotline was called? We know that our society is set up to police Black parents. So again, we all play a role in that policing system, and we all have a responsibility to challenge our bias and educate ourselves. And how do we create a society that works to understand instead of blame and punish?
It's a powerful space to leave folks in. Jen and Amanda, I really appreciate this conversation. And I think, as you both said, right, this is the start of a conversation that I hope we get to have. And I hope at some point we get both of you back and we're talking about some of the successes that we've had and some of the transformations that we'll hopefully make in the near future. Again, thank you both for coming.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much, Eric.
To learn more about how our evolution as an organization drives our mission to advance the well-being of children by investing in families to disrupt the systemic and multi-generational cycle of racial, social, and economic inequality, visit our Blueprint for Impact, available on our website and in the episode links below. Thank you again to Jen Agosti and Amanda Whitlock for your time, and to our sound engineer, technology wizard, / producer, Sarah Kruger. To learn more about all of our 2021 policy priorities, visit our website at www.childrenshomeandaid.org/thecenter. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Alquist Center. Before we end the podcast today, I'd like to make a very special announcement. We're now available on your favorite podcasting platforms. You can now find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Alexa, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For the Alquist Agenda, I'm Eric Mayo. Thanks for listening.